I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. All eyes are on what's being called the race at Case, the first and only vice presidential debate held tonight at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, where Dick Cheney, arguably one of the most powerful vice presidents ever, a seasoned former congressman and defense secretary, takes on John Kerry's running mate, former trial lawyer and first-term North Carolina Senator John Edwards, whose youth and charisma have vaulted him to the second spot on the ticket. Some are calling tonight's debate Shrek versus Breck. Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine, joins us now. And Richard, I know it's not your line, but you say it's a good one. Shrek versus Breck?
Look, if you to be serious for a moment, if you look at the polling numbers, the favorability ratings of these two men are the mirror images. Dick Cheney doesn't have great numbers even among Republicans, and in contrast, John Edwards does. Of course, John Edwards is less tested. We know less about him and how he's going to perform. And Dick Cheney, arguably, we know an awful lot about everything from his personal finances to his policy positions over many, many years. Mm-hmm. But you know, one does have an image problem, and one has a very pretty image.
Tell us, what do you think each man has to say?
A couple of things. First off, Dick Cheney, you can expect more of what we've seen on the campaign trail. Essentially, this is no time for America to change leadership or show any weakness in leadership. So we're going to hear a lot of that, hear a lot about defense cuts, and I expect he'll get into things like the trial lawyer thing, mm-hmm. especially good for Dick Cheney's base. On the other side, John Edwards, well, he'll go after two things, Halliburton and Iraq. On Iraq, I think he's especially going to seize on the comments of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld saying there was he'd seen no hard evidence of a link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq, something that the vice president has maintained from day one and still maintains.
We should say that Defense Secretary Rumsfeld has come back and said he was misunderstood on that comment, and he does see ties, so there's some flip-flopping there.
He says he was regrettably misunderstood. It was more than that, and it's an extraordinary day when you see Don Rumsfeld backtrack on his own words. This is exceptionally unusual. The other thing, of course, is Paul Bremer, the former lead administrator in civilian administrator in Iraq, saying huge mistake in not sending enough troops in Iraq. All of these things are going to be thrown back at Dick Cheney to say this was your war, it was mishandled and not justified in the first place. But, you know, John Edwards has his own hurdle to clear on foreign policy, and it's going to be interesting seeing him grilled on things like nuclear nonproliferation, North Korea, Iran, that kind of thing.
And why he voted for the war in Iraq and then didn't vote for the appropriations bill.
Right, same thing that John Kerry's had to deal with. It is a thread he has to loop through there. It's very hard to respond, much easier to attack.
Mm. The Kerry campaign spokesman, Joe Lockhart, says that he expects John Edwards is going to look Dick Cheney in the eye and ask, why didn't you level with us about Iraq? Will it be that pointed?
I imagine it will be particularly pointed. John Edwards has many things to prove tonight, and one of them is that he can be more than just a nice guy. That's the traditional role for someone in this position on a ticket. John Edwards has actually toughened up his rhetoric. He has dropped some of the motherhood and apple pie stuff he was doing, but he's still got a lot to prove that he can land a blow.
Does he bring up the aluminum rods, which Dick Cheney, more than anyone in the administration, seemed to see as a reason for suspicion of weapons of mass destruction? Does he bring up Dick Cheney's coupling of Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein?
Well, I think he will tonight, but that's not typically what he's done on the campaign trail. He keeps his comments, even criticisms, very general, very sort of soft focus, and that has been the criticism of him. But tonight is the test of that. Can he really pursue him as in fact, a trial lawyer would? Mm.
And one last question for you, Richard Wolff. The setup tonight, no podiums, a round table. Who does that benefit?
Well, you know, last time around, we all thought Dick Cheney was unused to this format, hadn't debated like this for many years, and was very dry and dour. And actually, this format suited him really well. And if you recall, he basically trounced Joe Lieberman. So I think this format actually helps Dick Cheney. You know, John Edwards on the other side hasn't had this kind of sustained debate at any point of his career.
Mm. Richard Wolff, we'll all be watching. Thanks for giving us a primer.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff, political correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Health officials in Britain announced today that the company that supplies half the flu vaccines in the U.S. will be shut down for 3 months because of manufacturing problems. The announcement comes as flu season begins and as health officials worldwide wrestle with a deadly outbreak of avian flu. 20 people have died in Asia this year after contact with diseased birds. It was thought that the strain of avian flu could be contained as long as the virus was spread bird to bird or even bird to man, as long as it wasn't spread human to human. That has happened. In September, a little girl in Thailand contracted avian flu. As she lay dying in the hospital, her mother came to care for her, and 2 weeks later, the mother died as well. That death set off alarms in the medical community. Human transmission of avian flu can lead to pandemic, the international spread of a deadly illness. So, we're going to take a few minutes to learn more about flu, avian and human. Earlier today, we spoke to Dr. Arnold Manto at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, which is a World Health Organization designated influenza center, and Dick Thompson, who specializes in communicable diseases and prevention for the World Health Organization. He joined us from Geneva, Switzerland. And first, I asked Dick Thompson, what happened to that little girl in Thailand who died from avian flu?
Well, she was living in a home that had chickens living underneath the main floor. In August, some of those chickens began dying, and her and her aunt disposed of these bodies. Probably as they disposed of the bodies, she inhaled some dust or some particles that contained avian influenza, and she became sick. Mm-hmm. Shortly after, she became sick on the 2nd of September, and shortly after that, her mother, who had been working in another village, came to see her on September 7th. She visited the home for about 10 minutes, and then she stayed with her daughter throughout the night, and the next day, her daughter died. Mm-hmm. Shortly after that, her mother became sick, and having no exposure, it's assumed and it's likely that her mother became sick from her daughter.
And we understand that the little girl's aunt and another child are also in isolation with the disease. This strain of avian flu is called H5N1. Clarify for us, because we thought that avian flu had also spread from bird to human and then from human to other humans in Hong Kong in 1997 and also in Vietnam this year, and yet we don't seem to have a pandemic. So why the concern now after the Thailand cases?
The concern is that somehow this virus will acquire the ability to move efficiently from human to human to human. There needs to be more investigation of the Thailand case, but we're 19 days out from the last confirmed case in this cluster, so it looks like it may not have gone anywhere. This could have been a dead end. Mm. But we need to examine these family clusters because they could be the ignition point of a pandemic.
And Dr. Manto, remind us of what the huge concern about a pandemic is. What can a pandemic do?
Well, pandemic, if we go back to 1918, this virus probably came from birds as well, though we don't have the exact details worked out as yet. But it did spread throughout the world, and with new revised figures, we think that about 40 million people died worldwide. Mm-hmm. And more than 500,000 in the United States, and we didn't have the population in the United States that we have right now. So if we had anything similar, it would be a catastrophic health episode.
And Dick Thompson from the WHO, remind us, because people might be saying, well, why not just come up with a vaccination for avian flu?
Well, in fact, there are two companies in the United States working on an avian influenza vaccine. And I believe that the United States has ordered 2 million doses of this vaccine. But we really don't know how effective it will be or how it will be used. There's some speculation that perhaps two different doses will be needed, two different injections will be needed to provide protection. Also, the virus itself could change so that the recipe that vaccine manufacturers are working with now may not be effective, may not provide the protection that you need later on.
It's the same problem that we have with human flu, and we're going to talk about that in a moment, but we understand that there's another predicament that health officials are in, because in vaccinating birds, as some countries are doing, you can actually make the situation worse for humans in the long run. Dr. Manto, how does that happen?
Well, I think there's a predicament in terms of vaccinating animals and perhaps not having clear evidence of disease but still having transmission occurring. That's the concern. And the quality of the vaccines may not be up to best standards. We would much prefer that we see the disease be able to control the disease. This is what we're doing in the United States. But the situation in Asia is quite different. Not only do they commercially produce chickens for export, but they also, there are a lot of backyard holdings. And so the situation there in controlling the avian outbreaks is quite different. But, and that's why, at least from my standpoint, the importance here is to look at the human situation to try, for example, to control these occasional human-to-human transmissions, which you hope will be dead-end by use of antivirals stockpiled for developing countries and eventually use of vaccine. Mm. But the vaccine situation is a complicated one because producing the vaccine is a bit different from producing the regular vaccine, and there are certain legal and other issues involving these vaccines which need to be worked out.
Which are they? I'm just curious.
You have to use certain new methods to produce these vaccines because the avian influenza viruses, if you inoculate them into eggs, will kill the eggs. And that's how we usually produce our vaccines. So you have to genetically modify the viruses. And this creates problems, especially in Europe, where genetically modified organisms are considered, if not dangerous, at least something you try to avoid, but also certain what we call intellectual property issues, because the process is patented and the patent is held by a couple of companies or universities.
Mm-hmm. Dick Thomas,
I could just say one thing, and that is that that's absolutely right. While there are two companies in the United States that are pursuing this vaccine, there are no companies in Europe doing this, and Europe produces 70% of the world's influenza vaccine.
So the other thing, if I can put in my we need to have incentives for the companies to work on this. Right now, we live in an economy where companies don't do everything just for the common good if it isn't for their stockholders' benefit as well.
We've been talking to Dr. Arnold Manto of the University of Michigan School of Public Health and Dick Thompson of the World Health Organization. When we come back, we'll ask them about fears that this strain of avian flu might actually hybridize with a human flu. And speaking of human flu, what are the predictions for this year's strain, and will there be enough vaccine to go around for that? That's next. Stay right where you are. This is Here and Now. And as always, a reminder, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We want to continue our conversation about flu, avian flu, and today's breaking news about the human flu vaccination. Earlier today, we spoke with Dr. Arnold Manto of the Michigan University School of Public Health and Dick Thompson of the World Health Organization. Dr. Manto was saying that one of the dangers of vaccinating chickens is that they may still be carrying avian flu, but look well, so that it gives a sense of false security. But I understand that there's also another concern that this avian flu strain that's killed two people in Thailand, H5N1, could actually hybridize with a human flu?
What we call it reassortment. What we worry about is that an individual human could become infected with avian influenza and simultaneously be infected with the human strain. The genes in influenza viruses are not neatly strung together. They're broken into pieces. So as they enter a cell, they fall apart. And if you get the two different viruses entering the same cell and splitting apart, they could reassemble in a way that what would emerge would be a virus that has the potential to move easily from human to human, but be as pathogenic as the avian influenza variety. So that we call that a reassortment, and that's our major concern.
Right. And so with these concerns and the fact that the World Health Organization and other organizations feel that human-to-human transition is the real alarm bell for a possible pandemic. What is the WHO doing to prepare for that?
We actually had a meeting in the spring to try to figure out what could be done, and we came up with a list of something like 140 different measures, but they're all sort of stopgap measures. These would be efforts to slow down the spread, because we don't believe it's possible to stop the global spread of an influenza virus. One of the more interesting ideas we heard was developing an international stockpile of antivirals that could be sent to a country, perhaps a developing country that couldn't afford them, to blanket an area once you'd seen human-to-human transmission start. And in this way, we might be able to smother the first outbreak of efficient human-to-human transmission and keep it localized.
Mm. Well, let's turn in the few minutes we have to the flu that's more likely to affect at least Americans in the near future and can also be deadly. Dr. Monto, what's the expectation of the flu strain this year? How virulent is it expected to be? Do we know what it is?
Well, we never try to predict what's going to happen, especially in early October before we've seen the flu season begin to develop.
By the way, Dr. Monto, how does someone know they have the flu as opposed to a cold? We had another story here in New England where a college kid stayed home with what he thought was just a cold, and he died.
Well, the way you can tell influenza is relatively easy if it's a more severe case right in the flu season. And we've actually done studies where we find that 80%+ of people who have cough and fever during the flu season have flu. It's pretty rare that somebody will die of influenza, especially in what we considered not high risk individuals.
Dick Thompson, I'm still struck by where we started. This image of a little girl in Thailand with a chicken she didn't know was sick, and she ends up dying from avian flu. Is flu with us forever?
Absolutely. And bird flu will probably be with us for a very long time. And that means the threat of an influenza pandemic will remain for a long time.
Our conversation earlier today with Dick Thompson of the World Health Organization in Geneva and Dr. Arnold Monto, an epidemiologist at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan. Well, since that discussion, health authorities in Britain have announced that ChironCor, the company that manufactures half of the flu vaccine used in the United States, will be shut down, its license revoked. So we called back Dr. Arnold Monto to find out what this means. Dr. Monto, your reaction?
What I would speculate is that we're probably going to have to deal with priorities for use of the vaccine we do have. We have been increasing the use of vaccine every year, so this will definitely have an impact. But we know who is at greatest risk of getting into trouble if they do have flu, such as older people, the very young, and those who have chronic conditions. Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that we're going to try to make sure that those people have first crack at the available vaccine.
We should say ChironCor's license was suspended for 3 months. The Health and Human Services spokesperson in Washington said they also aren't sure how this is going to affect the U.S. supply. And the ChironCor vaccine, Fluvirin, had contamination in it. So obviously this is concerning.
This is obviously concerning. What we have to do is see how this falls out. Fortunately, we're fairly early in the vaccination season, and I think we have time to develop contingency plans if these are actually needed.
Right. But as you pointed out, these vaccines are time sensitive. It takes a while to make them, and they can't sit on the shelf too long. So if the country has to get fully half of its vaccines replaced, the country will have to prioritize.
Well, it's going to be very difficult to get the vaccine replaced. that exercise was undertaken last year when there was a shortage of vaccine, and it did produce some extra vaccine, but not a whole lot. So I think there are going to be a number of approaches trying to get additional vaccine from the global market, and there is a global market in influenza vaccine.
You had mentioned to us earlier that there were some problems back over the summer with one of the two U.S. vaccines.
Well, this is apparently the same problem that we heard about this summer, in which there was a hold on the Chiron vaccine because of what we were told, and this is my information is the same as yours, was a contamination problem. Since we didn't hear anything further, I just made the assumption that everything was going to be worked out. And here we have breaking news, and basically we need to get more information so that we can see how the country is going to respond.
Dr. Arnold Manto, thank you for talking to us twice.
You're welcome again.
Bye-bye. Dr. Manto is with the Department of Epidemiology at the School of Public Health at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And this news just in, the National Institute of Health is now saying there will be a significant shortage of flu vaccine this season because of today's shutdown of the British-based Chiron Corps. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We continue our series of conversations about the presidential races in the swing states now, with a focus on Ohio and West Virginia, two states that voted for George Bush in 2000. Here Now, Bob Oakes spoke today with Bill Cohen, reporter with the State House News Bureau in Ohio, and Robert Rupp, history and political science professor at West Virginia Wesleyan University.
Bill Cohen, let me start with you. Cleveland plays host to the one and only vice presidential debate. Dick Cheney, Mr. Edwards tonight. Are voters in Ohio paying attention? Do you think this debate will make any difference in Ohio?
Yes, I think it will. Of course, you know, the conventional wisdom is we don't vote for the vice presidential candidates, and that's generally true. But, you know, we saw what happened with that first presidential debate, how the momentum has shifted, how, you know, a lot of folks were declaring Kerry the victor, and that's really has re-energized the Democrats, especially here in Ohio. There were polls last month showing Bush had surged ahead, and now we're seeing a lot of speculation that perhaps it's more of a dead heat as it was for several weeks. So I think, you know, a lot of politics is perception, and depending on what happens tonight, the perceptions could change.
You said a minute ago, before we went on the air, Robert Rupp, that West Virginia hasn't received this amount of attention since 1960.
Right. That was the famous 1960 primary between Kennedy and Humphrey, in which Kennedy basically undermined or helped undermine the religion issue by winning a landslide in West Virginia. And what's interesting, Bob, is that when he came down here, he was told that there were three F's in West Virginia politics: food, family, and flag. And the way I read the situation on the food issue, economics, Kerry is very strong. On the family issue, social values, Bush is very strong. And on the flag issue, you have to remember West Virginia has more VFW posts than we do high schools. It's a toss-up because Kerry is trying to make inroads on this question of the veterans.
Robert Rupp, Senator Robert Byrd is standing behind John Kerry in this race. How important is his support?
Senator Byrd's support is very crucial. He basically sat out the last election, in fact, many of the elections. Senator Byrd is now giving his blessing to Kerry, and Senator Byrd is known as protector of the coal industry. Another difference between this election, the last one, is the steel issue helped Governor Bush in the panhandle, and this time, of course, the steel issue is being turned around against him. So what we're seeing here is that the Democrats are trying to get blessings on coal, using the steel industry, and also, Bob, they're even going after the gun issue. We have a picture down here of Kerry holding up a shotgun given to him by the UMW. All this kind of shows that the Democrats are trying a full court press to try to make up for the mistakes they made the last time around.
Let me ask a specific question to both of you about the latest polling numbers then. And Robert Rupp, let me stay with you. What do the polls say about the Kerry-Bush matchup in West Virginia at this moment?
It was virtually a tie. There's been no poll since the debate. But what had happened is the state was starting to lean about 4 to 5%. Democrats were starting to get discouraged. And my estimate is we're back in the toss-up column where I think we're going to stay until the last week.
Okay, and Bill Cohen, you alluded at the beginning of the interview to the fact that the race seems to be tightening in Ohio. What do the polls actually say?
Well, the most recent Columbus Dispatch newspaper poll gave Bush about a 7-point edge over Kerry here, but most of it was conducted before that presidential debate, so it's very possible that the bounce Kerry apparently receiving that debate really doesn't show up in the Dispatch poll. So I think a lot of folks figure this is getting very close back to the way it was a couple months ago when it was neck and neck.
We know John Kerry's been focusing on the economy every time he visits Ohio. 230,000 jobs recently lost. I think we hear that number just about every other sentence that Kerry speaks in Ohio. When he was in Austintown yesterday, an area decimated by steel mill closings and other job losses. What's he talking about in the final weeks of the campaign?
Well, he is talking jobs. You mentioned the 200,000 figure. A lot of folks figured, I think, perhaps that the unemployment rate would be dropping gradually month by month, and that would be good news for Bush. But here in Ohio, it hasn't been dropping. It's actually been going up the last couple months. I think the last number I saw was 6.3% being Ohio's official jobless rate, and that's nearly a full point above the national average. So you'd think that Kerry would have the advantage on this. He should have some momentum in Ohio talking about jobs.
Robert Rupp in West Virginia, is it the economy or is it the war on terror and leadership?
I would say its economy is still number one, although the social issues are very important in this increasingly conservative state. I wouldn't say it was as much as the war on terror as the whole question of when it's framed as leadership. And George Bush is seen as a strong leader and a very pleasant president.
Bill Cohen, on the ballot next month, of course, in addition to the presidential contest, in Ohio, there's a ballot question that, if passed, would ban same-sex marriage. Is the Bush campaign trying to take advantage of that issue?
I think that the whole thing really is going to boil down to turnout and voter registration, not so much issues. I mean, everybody's pretty much already decided who they like. It's virtually a 50-50 split, and it's really going to all be boiled down to get out the vote and voter registration. And we have seen thousands and thousands of people registering to vote in the last few months here in Ohio, I think across the country. Yesterday was the deadline in Ohio for registering to vote, and we saw lines here and there. We saw tables set up on the sidewalk outside boards of elections, and that's really where I think the Kerry supporters are banking, that they have registered a lot of folks who were unregistered and that could be the margin of victory for them.
Robert Rupp, what about the get out the vote effort in West Virginia? Are you also seeing new voter registration? Are you seeing absentee ballot requests coming in at a high rate?
Yes, and we also have this early voting that I'm sure will be a key factor. Right, Bob, in West Virginia, as I'm sure in other states, it's almost as if the parties have given up on conversion and education, and they've gone most of their forces into mobilization.
All right. Let me ask you one last question each. Election day, 4 weeks from today, can George Bush repeat his wins in West Virginia and Ohio? And Robert Rupp, let's start with you, West Virginia.
I would say at this point he may not. The Democrats have had a full court press trying to neutralize the coal issue and the gun issue. If the Democrats can't carry this state now, they basically it will be a Republican state for the next 20 years.
Bill Cohen, Ohio.
Well, I think George Bush can pull it off. I think it's kind of his to lose. He won last time by 3.6%, and it's virtually a toss-up, but I think you have to give the edge to Bush at the moment.
Bill Cohen is a reporter with the State House News Bureau in Ohio. Robert Rupp is history and political science professor at West Virginia Wesleyan University, and they both spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. This week, we're visiting Iran with Vermont Public Radio journalist Steve Zind as he explores the country where his grandfather was born. Today, Steve wanders through the streets of the capital city, Tehran.
Iran is a nation of young people. 70% of Iranians are under 30. They gather in segregated groups, boys and girls standing in separate lines at payphones and at movie theaters. They gather in the squares where some girls clap and sing as boys hover within flirting distance. Women in Iran are required to wear the hijab, the Islamic form of dress. It can be a scarf and a manteau, which is a trench coat worn over pants, or the familiar chador, the black cloak that covers the head and drapes over the entire body so only the hands and face are visible. The chador doesn't have any buttons. A woman holds it closed with a hand on the inside and clenches it between her teeth. Law dictates that a woman's hair and the shape of her body have to be concealed. In Tehran's Lale Park, sidewalks wind through rows of dark green cypress trees and past roiling fountains and flower beds with pink and red roses. Women stroll holding hands, and sometimes men walk hand in hand. Young couples sit on shady benches out of sight of the police on the streets. Women are forbidden to associate with men who aren't related to them. The hypnotic call to prayer and muttered religious exhortations rattle from loudspeakers in the park. Old men sit on park benches, their heads bowed as if praying, but they're sleeping. When my grandfather, Muhammad Ali Zand, was born here in 1845, Tehran was a small provincial outpost. Today, it's one of the world's most populous cities.
Crossing the street.
The lack of traffic lights must be an acknowledgement of the futility of trying to control the country's drivers. Iran has the highest traffic fatality rate in the world. The streets are mechanized mosh pits of snarling horns, swerving cars, caterwauling motorbikes, and close calls. Motorbikes often with three or four passengers. Even cars routinely use the sidewalk. I learned to look both ways before I step from my hotel. The streets are packed with tiny stores. Clothing shops sell hats and shirts with the logos of American sports teams. Stores carry makeup, jewelry, and the stylish clothing that women wear when they're in their homes. There are kebab stands with skewered lamb cooking over charcoal. Fruit vendors sell tempting red crescents of watermelon. Bins of pistachios, roasted seeds, and glistening dates spill from the shops. For centuries, the bazaars have been Iran's centers of commerce. Narrow shafts of sunlight fall through holes in the high-arched ceilings and create a perpetual dusk inside the bazaars. Shoppers wander through labyrinths of crisscrossing passageways. You can find nearly anything here, from cheap plastic housewares to expensive Persian rugs.
Very old, very old.
You can see the classic design for the Tabriz, for Kashan or Adakan.
The carpet dealers invite you into their stalls.
Salam, salam. Merci, merci, merci.
They unroll carpet after carpet. Each one lands with a dull thud on the one before it.
Blue, 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 blue.
Okay, I have 240 by 150. Is it good size? Blue.
Merchants in the bazaar sell dried flowers and herbs and ochre-colored powders used for medicine. people still burn the bitter-smelling seeds of a plant called aspand to ward off the evil eye. As a village doctor more than a century ago, my grandfather might have used these herbs in his practice. In the afternoons, the shops close and the bazaar is quiet except for the songbirds in their cages. The merchants lie napping inside their stalls. It seems the centuries have brushed lightly past the bazaars. They're part of an old Iran that lies underneath newer realities that we see from the outside, the stern mullahs and the harsh official rhetoric. None of these qualities are evident in the people I meet. I sense in their warmth and in the timeless rhythm of the bazaars an unchanging culture that is beyond politics. It's an Iran that my ancestors would recognize.
Our visit to Tehran was produced by Vermont Public Radio's Steve Zind, with help from Sam Sanders. Tomorrow, Steve travels to the village where his ancestors lived, Paris. For more information and pictures of Steve's trip, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush and First Lady Laura Bush taped an hour with daytime TV's Dr. Phil to air this week. So did John Kerry and Teresa Hines Kerry, and he also appeared on Live with Regis and Kelly. Both candidates belatedly courting a voting bloc pollsters say could make all the difference on election night, women. And according to the Washington-based Women's Vote Project, single women constitute the country's largest group of non-voters just waiting to be wooed. But many women say they haven't heard either candidate talk much about issues that matter most to them. Debron Rowland is a civil rights attorney and author of the new book, The Boundaries of Her Body, The Troubling History of Women's Rights in America. And Debron joins us now in the studio. Hello.
Thank you.
And we have your book here. We'd need a truck to 4,000 footnotes and quite a lot of history.
Yes.
So we're not going to be able to talk about all of that, but we want to talk about how it applies to where we are right now. As you know, women, especially unmarried women, make up a huge voting bloc. In 2000, they voted more than men. In fact, more than Jewish, African-American, and Latino voters combined.
Mm-hmm.
What's different about the bloc this year?
You know, it's interesting to me. I'm not sure what the difference is and if there is an actual difference. I know that we keep hearing there's a difference. One of the things I find really interesting is for every poll that we hear, there seems to be an opposite poll.
Mm.
I wonder sometimes if this is really just superior campaigning.
Well, but you hear that, I mean, in 2000, Al Gore received 11% more of the women's vote than mm-hmm. George Bush did. And now, for the first time in a long time, that gender gap is closing and that mm-hmm. women are leaning more towards the Republican candidate.
Well, I think people keep saying one of the reasons is that the security issue, that mm-hmm. there's a lot of concern about where we're going to be with regard to a commander-in-chief. I think frankly, though, it's easy for people to talk about that. Neither one of these candidates wants to talk about women's issues. And so as a result, people tend to have forgotten where they are on these issues. And I think if we began to talk about this, and frankly, I think this is where Kerry makes a big mistake, is by letting the Bush campaign lead him into a place where he's silent about women's issues, because women do care about issues. Most women who say, I really am concerned about Iraq, also say I'm pro-choice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a They've skillfully managed to erase women's issues from this campaign.
The new so-called security moms have
right.
replaced the soccer moms in,
right.
in some thinking. Well, let's look at some of the other issues.
Okay.
Social Security.
Oh, you know, personally, I think, you know, we have the biggest deficit we've ever had, and now we're going to talk about revamping Social Security so that people have a smaller safety net. That really worries me, and it worries me for women because very often most people don't realize that women make less still than men most overall. And women, 50% of Americans get divorced, and women still overwhelmingly wind up with the children. So women wind up spending more money to support their households. As a result, you have women who are still poorer than men.
Mm.
So they rely more heavily on Social Security than on, you know, 401ks because, you know, they rely on it through their jobs. So we take this and we gamble with it and we make a mistake,
it affects women more.
Hugely.
In fact, some polls show that pay equity is the number one issue for women.
Yeah.
And the gap is growing there. So why isn't that an issue on the trail?
Well, it's funny. The gap is growing for regular people. In the Bush White House, women apparently make 78 cents on the dollar to what men make, which is higher than what women generally make. It's sometimes 70 cents, sometimes 76 cents. So I don't know. It's tricky, though. This falls into the area of sexual harassment law, and people are very, very clever about how it is that they pay women less. Very often, women will be doing the same work, but they'll have a different title. And they'll say, well, that's because she has a different title. He's the director and she's the assistant director when she's actually doing exactly the same work.
But again, we're not hearing about these issues because, if you say, the candidates have sort of painted each other into the corner of a rack.
Right.
What do you think about some of the language that's being used on the campaign trail to, for instance, characterize the candidates? I'm thinking of when Dick Cheney said that John Kerry wants to take a more sensitive approach to the war on terror, and Cheney said, Kerry seems to think al-Qaeda will be impressed with our softer side.
Yeah, this is a very clever administration with regard to the use of language generally. You know, they're essentially saying he's a wuss. What they're doing here is very skillful, but it's also typically divisive.
Yeah, well, but you know, obviously you lean to the left.
I lean to the law. You know, and I believe that people should be equal citizens, you know, and that's one of the frustrations here.
But in the end, if a large block of women decides that they just like George Bush better and feel safer with him, isn't that their right? Isn't that a woman's right?
Absolutely. The problem is that then you have a man in power who essentially believes, you know, and this is what's interesting. Under the law, my husband can't tell me that I can't have an abortion. Strangers would like the right to do that.
I want to, in the time that we have, I want to just take a minute to talk about the potential first ladies, the current first lady, Laura Bush.
Mm-hmm.
She's differed with her husband on issues. For example, she said in the past that Roe v. Wade should not be overturned.
Mm. Well, you know, Barbara Bush also differed with her husband, and that didn't change anything. The administration does what it wants. I think people sometimes imagine. And it's interesting. People imagine that the first lady, during the election campaigns, they imagine that the first lady is going to have some input. And then in the case of Hillary Clinton, everybody was furious that she had input. So, you know, I think that people get comfortable. I call people shoppers these days. They shop around for an issue that makes them either like somebody or hate somebody. I was at a signing not too long ago, and this woman said that she hated Teresa Heinz Kerry. And I said, well, why do you hate Teresa Heinz Kerry? And she said, because all she ever did was have babies. And I said, well, I don't understand. Is that a bad thing? Because that seems to be what everybody likes Laura Bush for, you know? And she said, I just think she's a horrible person. And she couldn't give me more specifics than that. And I think that there are just some people who look at women, you know, who are the partners of strong men or powerful men, and they decide whether or not they like that person based upon the woman's clothing, which is very superficial, the woman's strength. In the case of Hillary Rodham Clinton, everybody hated her, hated her because she was strong.
We should point out that she's also through the roof in her approval ratings with other people.
As a senator, though,
yeah.
Not as the first lady.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
And that might be that she now stands on her own. I think people are it's abrasive to some people to have a strong woman next to a strong man.
Do you think in the case of Teresa Heinz Kerry, that's the case?
I think there are a couple things. Personally, I think this is really unfortunate, but there's been a real xenophobia towards her. There's been a lot of, you know, she's staggeringly wealthy for one thing, and it sets her apart from other people. But people have made a lot about her being exotic or from Mozambique or Portuguese, you know, and I think those are all sort of those divisive words we were talking about earlier. There's a real, you know, it's sort of like they're saying she's un-American. And I think that is in play here, and that is very unfortunate to me.
Yeah. Just a quick, on a personal level, all of these issues I would think would resonate with you, especially the law, because as you write, you are a product of an illegal relationship.
Yeah, well, it wasn't illegal in my state, but it was illegal in most states. Yeah, absolutely. My parents were married in 1963. One was African-American, one is Caucasian, and until 1967, that was illegal,
yeah.
You know, in a lot of states. You don't ruin the world by changing.
Well, as I said, 4,000 footnotes in the book, and we can only get to a few topics, but Debron Roland, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Debron is a civil rights attorney and author of the new book, The Boundaries of Her Body, The Troubling History of Women's Rights in America.
Well, you can make me do what you want me to, but you got to know how. You can make me sigh, and you
You can make me cry, but you got to know how.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.